Before I call our last case, I wanted to recognize on behalf of the court that it is expected that today is Attorney Lang's last court appearance.
Oh, my goodness.
No.
Tell us it ain't
so. Mr. Lang is retiring from the public defender's office after 35 years in the office. Much of that time has been spent in this court. Do you have your win and loss record, Mr. Lang? Well, because I recognize you today and recognize your accomplishments and your public service for justice, doesn't mean you're going to win today either. That's a pleasant thought and one with which we can start the arguments. But it is not neither a prediction nor a predilection. It's just a statement. So that Mr. Collins doesn't feel in any way that this is a substantive issue in my recognizing Mr. Lang today. But, Don, thanks for everything. You've done good and you've done well. Can't do any better than that. Before we get maudlin, I'll call the next case. 13-AT-1737-CR and 13-AT-218-CR, State versus Lukey and State versus Weisinger. Now, these are two cases that we've joined for oral argument, but they are not consolidated. And the lineup looks as follows. 20 minutes for Mr. Lang, representing Mr. Lukey. 15 minutes for Mr. Boyle, representing Ms. Weisinger. 30 minutes for Mr. Collins, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. And then 5 minutes rebuttal Lang, 5 minutes rebuttal Boyle. Okay? That's what the lineup is. We'll follow it. We'll start off with you, Mr. Lang.
Thank you for the comments. And I should note, my very first court appearance was actually in this court in May, I believe, of 1980. So I get to start and end here.
Well, you may come back. You can't tell.
May it please the court. Don Lang appearing on behalf of the defendant appellant petitioner, Michael Lutke. Mr. Lutke was found guilty of operating a vehicle with a prohibited or a detectable amount of a restricted controlled substance. The charges were filed after the hygiene lab about 6 months plus after his arrest tested the substance for controlled substances. This appeal raises a substantive and a procedural claim that grows out of the unique circumstances of a detectable amount prosecution. First of all, as a substantive matter, it's Lutke's position today that in order to avoid absurd and potentially unconstitutional outcomes, the detectable amount provision must be construed to include a scienter element requiring that the driver at least know that he's ingested a restricted substance. An otherwise impaired motorist, because I draw this distinction throughout, if you're impaired, you're responsible. And whether you knew you ingested a substance or not doesn't matter, because as drivers, we're all responsible for monitoring our ability to drive.
But the jury did not find him impaired.
In this instance, the jury found he wasn't impaired. But an otherwise impaired motorist should not face severe felony penalties as a result of an unwitting ingestion of a controlled substance. So the young woman who slipped a date rape drug, the individual who chews on a piece of candy that somebody brought back from Colorado, or as is an inevitable theme of a sitcom at some point or another. The person who ingests the brownie or lasagna that has some substance in it, those individuals who don't even know that they've ingested a substance should not be found guilty of operating with a detectable amount in their blood. The legislative goal to deter drug driving simply isn't furthered if the person who is driving doesn't even know they ingested the substance. For those who do normally ingest, if I go up to Colorado, for instance, and buy some of their sweet candies and then come back here thinking, it's out of my system now, if I'm caught but I've knowingly ingested the substance, I am liable under the statute. But ultimately, what I'm asking for in this instance is the statute be construed to include the scienter element, and ultimately becomes a jury question whether or not the defendant knowingly ingested. In most instances, this is going to be pretty easy to show because of the surrounding circumstances. But in the end, it's got to be a jury question whether that's the case. That the statute should be construed consistent with the general rule that there's a scienter element in criminal provisions. And correspondingly consistent with the due process principle that a person shouldn't be convicted of something that they're unaware they've even committed. So the individual who couldn't register as a sex offender because they don't know where they're going to be living when they left the prison, the Lambert scenario where a person didn't know that they had to register as a felony offender under a local ordinance, or any other provision that makes it impossible to know that you violated the statute, would violate the due process. Again, I'm not asking that we declare the statute unconstitutional. My request is that we construe it to save the statute by including a scienter element, which this court has done and our U.S. Supreme Court has done when the statute didn't include the requisite scienter element. Meanwhile, as a procedural matter, inasmuch as these detectable amount prosecutions, the government's case, the defendant's case, hinge on the blood test result. In this narrow context, I'm requesting this court to construe the Wisconsin Constitution to provide greater protection against the destruction of evidence than is required under the bad faith test of Arizona versus Youngblood. That more specifically, consistent with this shifting balance of interest that was discussed in DuBose, once a case moves from investigation to prosecution, that once the state has elected to file a charge of a detectable amount in the person's blood, the state is on notice that the blood is the critical, in fact, the dispositive piece of evidence. And from that point forward, the state should not have the unilateral ability to just destroy the sample.
Now, what's the general rule in Wisconsin now about the...
Well, basically, any destruction of evidence in Wisconsin is measured under the Youngblood test. And as I point out...
It's a federal test, right?
Yeah. It's the federal due process test.
And the test is?
Essentially, if evidence is destroyed, the defendant always loses, is basically what the test is. But in more practical terms, if the evidence was apparently exculpatory, essentially there's a violation of due process if the state destroys the evidence. The difficulty with this kind of blood test, and frankly any kind of physical evidence whose evidentiary value can only be ascertained by actually testing it, it'll never be apparently exculpatory because it's always going to require further testing to determine its value.
Counselor, I have a question for you that came up. As I was reading your briefs and Mr. Boyle's and the state's, what happens if there's a blood sample taken? It's just enough to do one test. So there's nothing to throw away. You still have a claim before us?
Yeah, that's definitely not the problem here because they take two samples and they just don't even use the second.
Just say there was never another one. Nobody destroyed evidence. There was only enough material to run one test.
This is a hypothetical.
Yeah, under this hypothetical, under the Youngblood test, there would be no problem because there wouldn't be any bad faith because the only way it wouldn't be apparently exculpatory without the test. And then if you used it up in the process, there wouldn't be any bad faith.
Okay, so there's no claim.
I'm not asking for a test that addresses that particular problem. I think there's something to be said. Once charges are filed, the state ought not to engage in a test that uses up the product without notice to the court so the court can say whether or not this is warranted.
Well, if you're going to bring if you're going to bring charges based on what's in the sample and you test the sample and the sample is small enough that there isn't anything left over, I mean, that was kind of my question that ran through my mind as I'm reading all of this.
And that occurs when you're investigating sexual assaults and other kinds of crime where there's just a little morsel of blood. And the only way to test it, you're going to use it up. It's just going to happen.
There's no bad faith issue.
There's no bad faith involved. The question I have is, and I guess this isn't a rule we're discussing today, if you're post-charging so that there's already probable cause, should the state be able to unilaterally be the arbiter of whether evidence is going to be saved or not or how it's going to be tested?
Let's just look at the facts here because we have a different fact situation in the other case. Here, was he arrested?
He was arrested, yes.
Was he told that he could get an alternative test?
He was told he could get an alternative test as part of the process.
Okay. He was charged.
He was charged a long time later. And that's...
He was charged. Was the sample destroyed after he was charged?
It was destroyed after he was formally charged in terms of a complaint being filed, but in this instance, before he received notice of the charge.
I know, but the state had notice of the charge.
The state received the lab report in December 2nd, I think, of 2009. They filed their complaint December 18th, I believe, of 2009.
When was it destroyed?
It was destroyed February 4th, I believe, of
February 10. 2010. Yeah. Well, how come did the lab know that there were charges?
It's not clear.
Okay.
They knew they had a positive result. And, in terms of the state agency knowing that there's a positive, they don't necessarily know whether a charge is going to be filed.
Was this the crime lab, state crime lab? Was this the state crime lab?
State hygiene lab.
State hygiene lab. Okay, but it was the state agency.
That's correct.
As there was the district attorney, at least in terms of the DA being paid by the state.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is a different fact situation than the other one. So what are you asking the court to do in light of this? Is it that if there's a – you don't have any showing of bad faith here.
And I don't know that you could ever have a showing of bad faith when it entails another test and it's not apparently exculpatory. The only way you would have it is if somebody said, let's destroy it now because we think it might be favorable to the defense. And that just doesn't happen.
Well, what kind of rule do you want this court to adopt with? Is it that you want it to adopt a rule that after charging, the state cannot unilaterally destroy the sample?
I'm asking for a narrow rule that once charges have been filed for a detectable amount charge, that's the only area I'm talking about, that the state can't unilaterally destroy the sample until the defendant receives notice of the test result and has an opportunity to request an independent test. I am not asking that we overrule Walsted, Dish, and Ellen. I'm not asking for a rule that addresses broader disclosure, or I should say preservation requirements, that under my test, the state doesn't have to alter its investigation techniques. They don't have to do any more testing. The state doesn't have to be a permanent warehouse for blood tests, because I think once the defense has notice and is given the opportunity to request independent testing, at that point the onus is on the defense to continue to preserve and request the sample be kept.
There's an end game here where the state
doesn't just have to keep holding on to the stuff.
What's the end game?
The end game is once the defendant receives notice and has an opportunity to request. In terms of implementation, I should say...
How long does the defendant have?
I think the court can set whatever it thinks is a reasonable time. It always struck me that from the filing of the information, the court could set a time comparable to the statutory time for filing motions, other procedural motions. I think, I can't remember if it's 20 days. And it doesn't have to be a long time. The defendant at least has to know what the charge is, what the test result is, and have an opportunity to make a request.
Since
there's no discovery before the prelim, the defense counsel is not going to know how it all fits until after the information is filed, for the most part.
Where was the defendant between the time the complaint was filed on December 1809 and the time he returned on the warrant in May?
He was confined first in the Outagamie County Jail and then in the state correctional system.
Not on these charges?
Not on these charges, no. It was a separate matter. And therein lies why he didn't receive notice.
So you would tie the destruction to defendant getting notice and having an opportunity to ask for a test?
I think that's an easy way to administer the rule. I mean, I selected the charging point in time basically sort of along the Dubose balancing of how the case progresses from prosecution to defense. And just I picked that time as a matter of administrative convenience. Because once the state files the charges, they know they're in and they're using the test result. And so at that point, they have to know that the test result is critical to not just their prosecution, but any defense that might be available.
Why can't you say that you tie it to here's an arrest, and he was notified he could get an alternative time, an alternative test? Why don't you say he didn't ask for it a reasonable time after that?
Yeah. Well, you know, and here's, I think, the distinction between the typical OWI prosecution that we've talked about in Walsted and those three cases from long ago and the detectable amount prosecution. When you're picked up for an OWI, the old-fashioned alcohol case, you know what they're looking for. They're looking for alcohol. And you as the driver have reason to know, did I drink anything? Did I drink just a little so I'm not going to be over the limit? So you can make a calculated assessment, do I need to request a test or not? Now, the wisdom of doing so, you know, is debatable, but you at least are in the position to know what it is they're looking for and whether or not you might fit that. In the detectable amount case, essentially, as in this case, it occurs 6 months later or so, and they're going to screen for things that you may or may not even anticipate could be at issue. In this instance, for example, Detective Robertson, he was looking for, I can't remember how he checked his box, but he was looking for something completely opposite from cocaine. He was looking for more of a sedative drug. And in the course of running the screen, the cocaine pops up. At the time he's sitting there being asked whether he wants to have an alternative test, Mr. Lutke has no reason to suspect that cocaine's even an issue and that he should be asking for tests to refute the existence of something he doesn't even know that's there. And so in this respect, I think it's distinguishable from the Ellen, Walstead, Dish cases where the person, when they're asked if they want an alternative, that person knows what it is they're looking for and can weigh whether or not it's worthwhile to ask for an alternative. The person who doesn't know what's going to be found and has no reason to suspect it's going to be found has no reason to ask for the test.
Mr. Collins is an experienced prosecutor, but suppose you were invited to address brand new assistant DAs. What would you tell them about proof of scienter in these cases? How do you do that?
For the scienter element, that the jury has to find the defendant knowingly ingested a restricted substance.
Yeah, but how does the DA's prove it?
Oh, he proves it well, a multitude of ways. You can prove it from the surrounding circumstantial evidence. Was there paraphernalia? Was there other drugs found on the person? Did the person admit using it, which happens quite often? Is there somebody else who can identify or testify that they saw him using it? In some instances, the amount detected in the system will be so substantial that it's improbable that it could have been possibly unwittingly ingested. The amount in this case is extraordinarily small, so it's within the realm of distinct possibility that it was unwitting ingestion. Assuming the jury had the opportunity to consider whether or not he knowingly ingested it, could the evidence viewed in the light most favorable to the government have supported that finding? I suppose it possibly could if the jurors wanted to draw inferences from his behavior in hiding the syringes. But they also could have believed his claim that he hid the syringes because he was afraid, and believed his claim that I never do cocaine. They obviously believed other representations in order to find that he wasn't guilty of impaired driving, but the jury never was asked that question. As long as there was stuff in his system, he was guilty under the instructions.
Is scienter a remedy for improper destruction of evidence?
No, they're completely separate problems. I will say, though, in this case, and this is what struck me when I started working on it.
What difference does it make if the defendant knows what was in his blood?
Yeah, if a defendant knows that he's been using, he's probably not going to ask for an alternative test because he knows it's going to be there and be detected. The number of situations where there will actually be a request will probably be pretty small because there will be a lot of instances where the person knows there's something there, so they're not going to request it. But for those individuals who didn't realize they even ingested a substance, it's going to be important to have that second test. But they won't, at the time they're arrested, know there's a need to ask for the test because they won't have anticipated that there's going to be a substance that 6-8 months down the road was detected in their blood. The thing that's striking about this, I find it difficult to believe that the state has any interest in destroying these samples before the case is prosecuted. To the extent we want to have reliable outcomes and certainly limit the chance of tunnel vision affecting the prosecution, you would think we would want to have all available evidence available for testing. And to suggest, well, the defense could always cross-examine these guys, by its very nature, that puts the defendant at a disadvantage because he is unable to prepare and present the same nature of evidence that has the potential persuasive value that the state can offer. The state brings in its expert who's done the testing, and all the defense can say, well, did you do this or do that? If you can't present the same type of evidence, you're already handicapped in trying to defend the charge. And it strikes me that if the state wants reliable outcomes, it has no interest in destroying a sample that would preclude a second test. In this instance, they take two vials. There's another one available. So it's not like the state's ability to present evidence is compromised in any fashion by holding on to the test or the sample until the case is prosecuted. I see my red light is on.
Thank you, counsel.
Remind me to mention remedy when I speak in rebuttal.
Okay. I'll try and do that.
Anything else you want us to do while you're waiting?
Other than hold in your favor. Mr. Boyle, representing Jessica Weisinger.
May it please the court, my name is Gerald Boyle from Milwaukee, and before I can make my remarks, I'd like to inform the court that because of older age and military service, I'm somewhat hard of hearing, so I may have to ask the questionnaire to repeat. Thank you. I think it's more because of the military rather than age, but... The great Potter Stewart one time was asked in a case to define pornography. And he said, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. I guess what I'm doing here today is trying to get a handle on what due process means. It's something that I can't define. I certainly know it when I see it, and I certainly know the lack of due process when I see it. But to be able to affix words to what due process is virtually impossible. Now, there's a lot of cases were cited by counsels, all of us, and I read them all. I'm still confused. I do know this, that Miss Weisinger was involved in an accident. Two policemen, at least, saw her, talked to her. She went with one of the policemen to the hospital. She was never advised of her rights, and that's because neither police officer thought that she was under the influence of anything.
She was not arrested.
Beg your pardon?
She was not arrested, was she?
She was not arrested, no, ma'am. She voluntarily said she'd be happy to do it. The officer basically said, well, since this may end up being a fatality, it's better that we get this on record. I really believe that the officer was just making sure that he covered all the bases. He didn't read her any rights of any kind, didn't tell her about testing or non-testing other than the fact that she was, was going to be given blood. And what happened was many months went by. A test was done on ethanol and alcohol and was found that she didn't have any in her system. A test was done on everything else, found that she did have some marijuana in her system, but she wasn't told that. And the police department wasn't told that. But there did come a time when another test was done, and she was found to have had a prohibited amount, and subsequent thereto, she was charged with the crime, which brings us all together here today. The problem was that the first test on alcohol had a big stamp on it. 60 days from now, the specimen will be destroyed. What happened with the test on THC, no such matter was put on that form. She suddenly finds herself arrested, but by this time, for whatever reason, the State Department of Hygiene, I don't know why we talk about the police department because they didn't do it, State Department of Hygiene had destroyed the blood sample. It didn't exist. As time progressed, knowing, as Judge Riley in his dissent points out, two elements. One, were you driving with a prohibitive amount? They got that. And did you cause the injury? Of course. So there's very little in this case that isn't total strict liability. And, of course, the way it turns out, it's absolutely strict liability because the state was only required to prove that there was a report without any blood being in existence that could have been checked out, that there was blood, there was a report that the blood showed that marijuana was in her system. That was it.
Just so we know what the facts are.
Say what, Your Honor?
I want to know what the timetable is, Mr. Boyle.
Yes, ma'am.
What month were the tests made?
I think the accident was in July.
Right.
The alcohol was done in August, almost right away. The first drug test I never knew anything about, anything.
Must have been done within a short time after the alcohol.
I'm sorry, Judge.
The drug test, wasn't it done a short time within the accident?
Well,
the
a little bit after the alcohol, but it was never made known.
Okay. But, all right.
And then we go after the first of the year, and I have it all chronologized
in
the brief.
Mm-hmm.
After the first of the year, there's a test done again, and the finding made that there was THC in her system. Nobody was notified of that. That certainly that I don't know of, and nobody on our side of the fence was notified of it. And then it was destroyed.
Okay.
Then she was charged, and the rest is history. She went to trial and lost. Well,
the difference between the two cases is it was an arrest in the first case immediately, right?
There was no arrest with her at all.
No arrest here until, okay.
There was no arrest at all.
She, in the first case, the destruction of the evidence is after the charge.
Right.
And in this case, it's destruction before the charge.
Right.
Does that matter?
Right.
Is there a difference?
Oh, absolutely there's a difference. If I had been her lawyer and she had been arrested within close proximity to when the accident happened, I would have been saying, where's the reports? I want to see the reports. The fact that it went so long, and then finally they arrested her, and we didn't get the reports until after the preliminary hearing was waived, I'm not going to be a fool and start asking at that time for reports that don't seem to be such as to cause me the great concern that it came to be as I was getting ready to get this matter for trial. When it got to the point where I have nothing, they have nothing, they don't have anything at the scene, they don't have any police officers saying she appeared to be intoxicated or have something in her system, nothing. They didn't find anything in the car, they didn't find anything on her, they didn't see anything of her demeanor that would cause them to believe that she was under the influence. Now I have to make a judgment, where am I going with this thing? The state, you know, we're always trying to get this thing taken care of without trial. The state was not moving, and then I say, all right, you leave me no alternative, I got to test the blood. Because testing the blood is going to end the thing one way or the other.
Counsel, what do you think of Mr. Lange's argument today that the person, this would not result in very many tests, because the person who uses a large amount would never want to have this tested?
Of course not.
Well, how's your client fit within that paradigm?
How can we what, ma'am?
Didn't your client have a lot of THC in her system?
No. Not at all.
Do you think that yours and Mr. Lange's arguments here really belong before the legislature?
I don't think we have the same case at all. I think his person had been arrested. They had found a lot of other incriminating evidence. Nothing on my girl. Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Right, but his is an operating under the influence case, right?
Right.
And yours is operating with a detectable amount, a homicide, right?
Well, it's strict liability, any amount. Any amount.
Right.
It's automatically guilty. So eventually the defense lawyer has to make a decision. I mean, what am I going to do? I have nothing going for me. So I say, all right, let's test it. Now, we know when we ask for it to be tested, we may very well be signing a death warrant for the client. So I didn't do that, and obviously, not that it makes any difference, but if I had learned that she was using THC the day before that accident, I wouldn't ask for it. It's when there was nothing, and I saw nothing, and there was no other evidence whatsoever, that I had no alternative but to ask for it. I would have been negligent in not asking for it and been subjected to some scrutiny as to why I didn't ask for the test. It's when I asked for the test that Mr. Sisley, the prosecutor, a very fine prosecutor that he is, indicated to me, well, I'll get it for you. I don't know where it is right now. And then he called the State Department of Hygiene and found out that it was not in existence, that it had been disposed of. Now, I don't know why they have to dispose of it. You know, in murder cases, they don't dispose of fingerprint evidence after a period of time. They don't dispose of DNA after a period of time. Why these folks decide, and I can understand it, they got a lot of it, and that's probably their primary consideration. But when it comes to THC, that's, you know, if you got alcohol, they got to have a level of 0.08. If you got THC, you don't have to have anything but a segment, something that shows THC. Why they have to dispose of that evidence, I have no idea. And then they do not inform anyone that they have a right to be have a test. Now, I'm sure that was a mistake. I don't think, and how I'm going to be able to prove bad faith, no way. These officers were so forthright. They were so honest about the situation. How could I even start to claim bad faith? And how could I say, well, it was potentially exculpatory? It's a guess. I don't have any idea what was going to show up. I do know one thing. Nobody will ever know. And even though we'd like to think those people do their job and don't make mistakes, we all make mistakes. We all make mistakes. And that's why I did what I did. Yes, Your Honor.
Did the absence of your ability to have a second test influence your decision to try this case to the court as opposed to a jury?
I tried it to a jury.
Oh, you did try it to a jury.
It was a jury decision. Okay. And the reason I tried it to a jury, because Judge Williams, who's an outstanding jurist, has already made a finding, although she gave me the ability to cross-examine more than I would otherwise be able to cross-examine, she had really made a decision that that report was admissible, and that meant that if I tried it to her, the case was already in.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Both of these were jury trials, weren't they?
Beg your pardon?
Both of these cases were jury trials.
Mine was.
Mr. Lang can answer that. So what kind of rule do you want this court to adopt?
Say again.
What kind of rule do you want this court to adopt?
Well, this is a different one than this gentleman that just addressed the court.
Okay. He's Tell me what rule you want for your case.
He's got to come up with something. I don't. I have to say that when they make a mistake like they made here, the case should be just dismissed. And all the other verbiage and all these other cases is all interesting and everything else, but it doesn't have anything to do with my case. Somebody messed up, and when somebody – and I had been a prosecutor.
What's the mess up?
Say what?
What is the mess up? What is the mistake?
They threw away the blood.
Well, they have a rule that says they can do it in 6 months. They waited the 6 months and destroyed it.
They were just
following the rules.
But they didn't wait 6 months. It was shorter than 6 months, I believe. But nonetheless, you're right. It was a long time. But they shouldn't have done it. Why did they do it?
Well, then do you want a rule that they should retain all evidence at all times?
Absolutely. Don't they have to retain in a trial that results in a guilty finding? Don't they have to retain the evidence in that until the appeal time is run? That, you know, we're sorry they have to do it, but they have to do it because the case might be overturned. So how does the crime state hygiene get off saying, well, they don't have to keep theirs because we don't make mistakes in our reports and the courts will allow all our reports to get in without challenge by the defense?
Well, then I hear you say you want a rule that the lab has to keep all samples until the appeal ends. Well, they may never be any charge, right?
Right. There wouldn't have been a charge in this case.
Well, if there were no charge, how long does the lab have to keep the samples?
Well, if there was no charge, they didn't have anything to destroy. They've already destroyed it. Do I misunderstand the Chief Justice's question?
I think so, Mr. Boyle. The lab has a sample. The sample shows traceable amounts of illegal substances. Now that lab, that sample sits in the lab, and now it's 6 months, it's 8 months, it's a year. And so they say, I'm dumping it.
Well, here's the surprise in this case, Judge. Yeah. It's different than others. There was no clue that the blood had been destroyed by either the prosecutor or the defense. So when we went seeking it for testing, the prosecutor learned that it had been destroyed. That makes it a novel situation. If there is a rule to be made, it is that the State Department of Hygiene must not destroy potentially incriminating evidence until the prosecutor accepts that fact and tells them they can do it. Because it's the prosecutor's case. He's only got to prove, basically, in this case, one thing. And he should say, don't rid yourself of that evidence until I tell you.
That's the rule you want.
That's the rule I learned. And when I was a prosecutor, I did that. I would tell them what to do and what not to do.
Mr. Boyle, you were a former prosecutor. How would the prosecution ever have proved knowledge on the part of your defendant?
They couldn't have done it. There was nothing, Judge. I mean, absolutely nothing. The police saw nothing. They were surprised when she was found to have had it in her system. There was no evidence of any wrongdoing on her part as far as ingestion of controlled substance. They had nothing except that report. And that report was based upon findings that were made on blood that had been destroyed that she could not have challenged. That's why this case is so unique. And really, they make a mistake like this, they got to. The consequences are the case goes south. It's gone. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Boyle. Senator Collins.
May it please the Court. As the Chief Justice explained, I am Wynn Collins, and I represent the respondent, State of Wisconsin, in both State versus Lukey and State versus Weitzinger. The State respectfully asks this Court to affirm the Court of Appeals in each case, thereby affirming the judgment of convictions and sentences imposed by the Circuit Court. Your Honors, this case is about fidelity to precedent and respect for the legislature in its enactment of its laws. This Court should not interpret greater due process under the Wisconsin Constitution than the federal Constitution for two reasons. First, this Court should adhere to precedent, and second, Lutke and Weitzinger received due process in their cases. And this Court should also not insert a scienter element into the operating with a restricted controlled substance statute for two reasons. First, it is a strict liability offense. And second, Lutke has not met his burden to overcome the presumption in favor of constitutionality. Turning to the first point, this Court should adhere to precedent. As this Court has identified, there are two levels when confronted with challenges to precedent. As the Court identified in Johnson Controls, the first level requires looking at whether the precedent is incorrect as a matter of law. And then, the second level, as identified by Outagamie County Board of Adjustments, is for the Court to view the precedent under a series of pragmatic and prudent considerations. There are three distinct branches of precedent that are threatened by what Lutke and Weitzinger are asking this Court to do. First, they're challenging settled law that this Court entered in 1984 in the Walstead, Allain, and Dish decisions, which found that generally there was no due process violation when blood or breath ampule are destroyed in the routine course of an OWI, impaired driving, or the like. Second, the defendants are challenging the Pankow and Greenwood decisions that establish the bad faith element that a defendant must show when the evidence is merely only potentially useful evidence at the time of its destruction. And third, the petitioners are challenging this court, the appellate court decision in Greenwood 2, the Wisconsin Constitution does not provide any greater due process protection within the confines of evidence, destruction, and retention. There is no compelling reason, Your Honors, for this Court to overrule precedent. First, the cases I have just cited were all correctly decided. What is unique when reviewing precedent is that in these cases, you had almost immediate validation by federal courts of the reasoning of state courts. And the reason for that is when this Court in 1984 issued Walstead, Dish, and Allain, the same month, the U.S. Supreme Court issued its Trombetta decision and reached the same conclusion that this Court independently raised, and that is that there is generally not a due process violation for the destruction of a breath ampule or comparable blood sample. Similarly, when the appellate court in Pankow acknowledged the bad faith requirement in the test, that predated the Youngblood decision, and that decision was later validated not only by Youngblood, but by subsequent appellate court decisions establishing the same rule. And finally, when this Court addressed Dubose, it was certainly made aware, and it was even noted in Justice Wilcox's dissent, about the Greenwald decision, and yet nowhere in the majority did the Court overturn Greenwald 2. So the settled
law... None of these you have to be careful. DuBose didn't involve a blood sample, did it?
Correct. It was an eyewitness identification procedure.
Right. And that was not allowed. That was a show-up case, if I remember it right.
Yes, it was when this court overturned Wolverton.
And the other cases you cited dealt with the breath test. Anything else on blood?
Yes, actually, Elaine and Dish involved blood. It was Wallstead and Trombetta that involved breath.
And did they involve the issue of when the destruction was and why? Was it before the charge, after the charge, before arrest, after arrest?
A little bit of both. In the Elaine decision, it was before charges, but the Dish decision is quite comparable to Lutke's case. In fact, it was even stronger in some respects for the defendant, because the defendant had requested preservation of the blood. The blood was then used for further drug testing and was no longer available to the defendant for retesting post-charge.
It wasn't destroyed. It was just used up in that case.
Yes. The comparable, though, Your Honor, is that the retest for drugs in Dish actually occurred after the defendant's request for preservation.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no reason under the first prong, the first level of analysis of this stare decisis. And so turning to the second, which the Outagamie County Board of Adjustment case described as prudent and pragmatic considerations, but Bartholomew broke up into five parts, none of those are met here. The first would be whether there are legal changes or developments in the law that would render the precedent no longer valid. Next would be whether there's newly ascertained facts. Third would be whether there's legal cohesion or consistency or problems thereof. Next would be whether it is unsound in principle or finally unsound in practice. This case and the petition that Lutke sought and Weitzinger responded to involve really only the first prong, and that is whether or not DuBose is a fundamental legal change or development of the law so as to render these three branches of precedent no longer valid. And this gets to the Chief Justice's question, which is precisely what did DuBose decide? DuBose decided that with regards to a specific identification procedure, that being a show-up, Article 1, Section 8 of the Wisconsin Constitution afforded greater due process protection. In doing so, the court noted that it was going to overturn Wolverton and its related cases. However, DuBose did not create a precedential sea change. As I already noted, Justice Wilcox identified the Greenwald 2 decision, and it was not overturned by this court in DuBose. And subsequent cases, specifically Drew, Hibble, and Ziegler, did not expand DuBose. DuBose was not expanded into other identification procedures in Drew. It was not extended for spontaneous identifications in Hibble, and it was not extended to a single showing of a mugshot or photograph in Ziegler.
You view DuBose as an outlier?
Your Honor, I believe that what the court was doing in DuBose was actually complying with the Bartholomew factors, specifically citing Johnson control. The majority in DuBose only overruled precedent after finding that Wolverton, that two of the factors were met, specifically the second and the third. And the court identified in DuBose that it was finding that there were newly ascertained facts that made Wolverton unsound in principle. And we have almost the exact opposite situation here. The irony for Lutke and Weitzinger to rely on DuBose is that that doesn't support their position. DuBose only overruled precedent after finding that eyewitness identification or misidentification was the single greatest cause of wrongful conviction in the U.S. Here, what we know from Trombetta is that the retesting of these blood samples are unlikely to lead to any evidence that will be exculpatory to either of the defendants. In fact, what the court found in Trombetta is in everything but the tiniest fraction of cases will this evidence ever be valuable to a defendant. We had the same concession made today by Weitzinger's attorney, where he said the retesting of the blood is essentially signing the death sentence to your client. And you would only seek retesting when you have no other defenses available. And perhaps that's why Weitzinger waited 22 months from the blood draw to even first seek retesting. So when DuBose is a limited holding to a very specific issue that the court identifies as the single greatest problem with wrongful conviction, it would be quite a stretch to then take that decision and apply it in what Trombetta has identified as evidence that is almost never likely to lead to evidence beneficial to a defendant in all but the tiniest fraction of cases.
You know, as I read Mr. Boyle's brief, I think he would be saying, to put it into your rhetoric and language, he would be saying there has been a change in the law. And the change in the law is Crawford, which says that the test alone is not good enough. You got to have a witness who can be cross-examined because the report is testimonial. Now, I'm somewhat stating all this broadly, but that might be the essence of his argument. Now, you object to his relying on Bull Cumming because he didn't put it in his petition for review, but why doesn't that fit with your argument that there's been a change in the law, that they now need expert witness and need it to so that it can be there can be cross-examination?
Well, Your Honor, with respect to that, certainly the State doesn't believe that it was the issue before the Court. But to answer your question directly, what we have here is a circuit court judge who was cognizant and conscientious of the issues and said, we're not going to let you call some other analyst to just testify about what the report says. Because the blood is no longer in existence, I'm going to order that the specific analyst who performed the blood sample, Amy Miles, is going to have to be here to testify. So there's no confrontation issue. There's none with regards to how it was handled by the circuit court and none with respect to how it was ultimately addressed by the court.
Well, if we would accept your view, do we have to adapt or adopt the trial court's position that the analyst himself or herself has to testify?
No, Your Honor. What the State is advocating is that when we get to a procedural due process question, it is not a black and white. It is not a simple sort of roulette wheel of justice where some defendants get out of jail free simply because the blood doesn't exist, but that we have faith in the circuit court judges to balance, because procedural due process is all about balance. And it is not whether there is a single dispositive fact, but whether the circuit court can look to the case and decide what might be appropriate.
Okay, so what do we balance in Ludtke, and what do we balance in Weisinger?
Well, when we look to the Dish decision for guidance, and certainly we look to the facts of these two cases, there's no fewer than 10 potential ways that we can protect the due process. It's not going to be that every prong is going to be available in every case. But we have certainly the opportunity statutorily, as was made available in Ludtke's case, for an alternate test. In both cases, we have the constitutional and statutory right to the discovery being the second one. In Mr. Ludtke's case, the court granted an adjournment so he could have more time to request records under a public record request to the laboratory. So we have the public record opportunity to impeach the lab. Fourth, we certainly have time to prepare a defense, and I don't want to diminish that, because both circuit courts granted the defendants repeated adjournments at their request for more time to look into experts, alternate records, and the like. We also have exclusion under the rules of evidence. What's noteworthy is when this court decided Hibble and did not extend Dubose, it pointed out the fact that defendants have every right to move for exclusion under 904.03, as specifically that the probative value of the evidence is substantially outweighed by confusion of the issues to the jury or misleading the jury.
Neither. I have to go back to the question that I asked counsel earlier. My understanding of the chemist's testimony was that this person tested for amounts of THC that were significant, indicating she may be a likely daily user. Do you see Mr. Boyle and Mr. Lang's arguments as fitting together? Mr. Lang, I thought, was saying, gee, you know, don't punish somebody who had a friend slip them a gummy bear that came back from Colorado, right? And they couldn't possibly know that had THC in it. And that person never would know, you know, to ask to have it tested. You're not going to have that many tests that are requested, whereas for sure the person who's a daily user isn't going to ask to have it tested because they would know they would have THC in their system. So tell me how you think that fits, or is that sort of irrelevant to you?
Your Honor, to a certain extent it's irrelevant, and the reason is that with the facts of these two cases, Ludtke's advocating that he had a small amount, but it's clear from the testimony that it was not even recorded as a positive result until you get to 10 nanograms, and sort of left out of the calculation that it's not only the cocaine, but it's also the metabolite of cocaine, which was 330 nanograms in Mr. Lutke's system. So the state doesn't accept the argument that he had necessarily a small amount. Ms. Weisinger was given free and full rein of cross-examination, and quite frankly, I think defense counsel might have taken that too far, because it was only in cross-examination that the fact that she was her levels of both Delta-9 and the metabolite were indicative of being a chronic user of THC. When the legislature created the strict liability offense, they did not include all THC. They only included Delta-9, and Delta-9, as we know from Ms. Weisinger's transcript, has a very short half-life. Half of it leaves the system in approximately 1 hour. So the metabolite is not used to prosecute people who smoked a joint a month ago. The Delta-9 is indicative of recent use. However, we can look to the metabolite level, as Your Honor pointed out, to show that she was, in fact, likely a chronic user. On the point that you raise about the retest and how it's only going to be done on a few occasions, it's circular from the arguments presented by Mr. Lutke's attorney. He said no one who's a chronic user is going to ask for it, and no one who isn't a chronic user is going to think to ask for it. So we're going to end up with nobody asking for it.
Then why is the state objecting?
The state is not objecting to defendants having the right to get a retest.
Oh, if you destroy the evidence, you're objecting.
Your Honor,
saying they can destroy the evidence in 6 months.
The state's position is the statutory remedy that the legislature created. It is not a retesting of the blood 17 months or 33 months later or 22 months later. The statute provides an alternate test at the night of the incident. Mr. Lutke had the opportunity to get the test the night of the incident. It wasn't just one test, Your Honors. The statute provides for two. He gets the test administered at the officer's direction. The statute then provides that he can get a second test for free, and he can get a third test at his own expense. The problem with relying on retesting of the blood, as opposed to relying upon the test the night of the incident, is that it's sort of taken at face value in these cases that somehow blood that is 17 months old, 20 months old, or 22 months old has any evidentiary value. Left unresolved by both circuit courts is any finding that the blood would have had any evidentiary value at the time Ms. Weisinger first asked for retesting at 22 months. Although it was destroyed at approximately the 7-month window, as Ms. Weisinger's attorney pointed out, he wasn't going to retest it. He wasn't going to seek retest until he realized it was the only thing left. And that's why he called it the death sentence to his client. So it's sort of a windfall to sit and wait for 22 months and suddenly seek a retest of something that is unresolved whether it had any value. But evidence taken the night of in the statutory alternative test is something that would provide evidentiary value to people. Now, in Ms. Weisinger's case, that was not provided because she didn't meet the statutory elements for it. She wasn't under arrest. And this is largely an academic point in Ms. Weisinger's case, because as I pointed out in a footnote in my brief, the legislature amended the statute so that officers can now use the informing the accused for a person in Ms. Weisinger's position who causes great bodily harm or death to another person while committing a traffic violation. That wasn't available to the officer, and it would be improper for the officer to have read the informing the accused at the time, because it would not have made any sense. The opening is after having been arrested, which she had not.
Can we go back to you were saying that procedural due process in these cases is not black and white, that the trial court has to balance factors. And I think you got up to the fifth factor.
Correct.
And then we're interrupted by other questions. So what are the other four factors?
The right of cross-examination, the ability to attack credibility. That would be the sixth and seventh. The eighth would be expert witnesses. The ninth would be applicable in some cases to pursue an affirmative defense. And finally, seeking a jury instruction. It is noteworthy that Ms. Weisinger...
What kind of jury instruction?
I'm sorry?
What kind of jury instruction do you seek?
Ms. Weisinger asked for a jury instruction, and the court gave it to her as her attorney presented it. Mr.
Which
Lutke's,
was?
It was informing the jurors of the fact that the evidence had been destroyed, and she was not given the opportunity to retest. Mr. Lutke forfeited that right by never seeking and never objecting to the jury instruction conference. Now, ultimately, what we end up with on the first question before this court, and I think it came evident through the oral arguments, is that this court should adhere to precedent because it leads to consistency in the law. Now, I understand that Ms. Weitzinger essentially avoids discussion of precedent, and Mr. Luedtke tries to take the tact of an end-run around precedent. But as a concurrence in the State versus Genrich identified, an end-run around precedent is just as detrimental to its fidelity. You can't carve up precedent into distinct and unrecognized.
What are you talking about, the scienter element now or the destruction?
On the destruction.
On destruction, okay.
What we end up with is Luedtke asking for a rather unusual result. While asking this court to not look and follow fragile precedent, what he is ultimately doing is asking this court to then look to the Kirby decision, a Sixth Amendment right to counsel post-charge, and graft that on to due process under the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment, but then ignore all federal precedent and constitutional law and graft that due process into our state constitution. This distinction was rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Fisher case, and it will lead to inconsistent results, and that's evident today. Mr. Luedtke asked for a pre- versus post-charge distinction. Ms. Weitzinger wants the informing the accused to be the linchpin, and the only judge who dissented in the Court of Appeals in the Weitzinger decision wanted sort of an especially critical standard. The state is not asking for this court to carve up precedent in unrecognizable parts. What the state is asking, Your Honor, is that we follow and adhere to the precedent because it has produced a settled body of law, and the factors are not present in this case.
And the precedent is, summarize that for us.
The three distinct branches. The fact that this court should affirm the Elaine, Dish, and Wallstead decisions. That's branch one. Second, that this court should affirm the Pankow and Greenwald standard, which is the test. And third, the recognition in Greenwald 2 that with respect to evidence preservation and destruction, the standards are the same in state and federal constitutional law.
Why isn't that just the key thing, the third factor?
I apologize, Your Honor. What was
why isn't that you use the same test in state and federal law, the key factor here?
Well, that is, Your Honor, with respect to the second branch of precedent, that the two lines have matched up. And we have a long line of precedent that has served a purpose, and we don't have that sort of critical issue at play here. Because in both cases, what we know is the evidence at best was highly unlikely to produce any exculpatory evidence to these defendants. It is worth noting that this blood was not tested once positively for the presence of cocaine in one case and THC in the other, but multiple times. It's laid out better in the factual record in the trial of Ms. Weitzinger. But this, contrary to CSI, the drop of blood is not simply put in a machine and it's all run. The State Lab of Hygiene has to go through a series of steps and tests. They sort of do an up and down test for drugs. And Ms. Weitzinger's came back positive for THC. And Mr. Luedtke's came back positive for cocaine. They then have to subject it to a second independent test using an independent portion of the specimen to get the critical amount using, I believe it was the gas spectrometer. And so much like the Fisher decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, we are dealing with multiple positive results, and yet we're left to believe that somehow it would be a different result in all likelihood. As acknowledged by Ms. Weitzinger's counsel during argument here, it's more likely to be the death sentence of the defendant. I want to make sure that I have time to address the point raised by Mr. Luedtke that was not raised by Ms. Weitzinger on the strict liability. And so turning to that point, I want to get to the legislature's enactment of this statute. In 2003, the Wisconsin legislature enacted operating with a restricted controlled substance in what was called the Baby Luke Bill. And when it did so, it created a strict liability offense, which is certainly not unheard of in the law. As we know from this court's precedent in Jadowski, there are several factors this court can look to in determining whether, in fact, we have a strict liability statute. It is also worth noting that in Jadowski, this court found that sexual assault with a child is a strict liability offense with respect to the child's age. And so even if the child misrepresents their age, shows a false identification or the like, the individual is still assumed to have strict liability and cannot introduce that as a defense. And so even under crimes that carry significant criminal penalty, this court has recognized the benefit of such laws, particularly when enacted by the legislature. If we look to the six Jadowski factors, the first is where we often start, and that's with the statutory language itself. The plain language of the statute omits any element of intent or knowledge. And this court has found that jury instructions can be persuasive, as identified in Olson. And when we look to the jury instruction for this offense, it confirms that, in fact, this is not a strict liability offense. What we have is two elements, that the defendant operated a motor vehicle or drove a motor vehicle on a highway, and second, that the individual did so with a detectable amount of a restricted controlled substance in their blood. Clearly, under the first Jadowski factor, it is pointing towards strict liability. When we look to the legislative history, which is the second Jadowski factor, we see that that is also one where the legislature intended to be strict liability. The legislative council member focuses primarily on the impairment removal, but it identifies that evidence of a detectable amount is sufficient for prosecution. When we go to the third factor and we look at related statutes, we see that similar strict liability in prohibited alcohol concentration, absolute sobriety, and these are offenses that have no element of impairment. Particularly, it's noteworthy that a fourth offense, prohibited alcohol concentration, would be .02. A person may have no signs of outward impairment, may not exhibit any signs, and yet they would face the same strict liability that an individual who uses a restricted controlled substance would have. If we go to the fourth Jadowski factor, and this is certainly one of note here, is the enforcement practicability. The legislature created this offense under a very simple pursuit, and that was safer highways. If this court were to usurp the role of the legislature and insert an element that the legislature never intended, it would certainly undermine the legislative goal of having a practical and enforceable law. Contrary to Mr. Lutke's counsel, who said it would be pretty easy to show impairment, when confronted with a question from Justice Prosser, he said, well, maybe there'd be paraphernalia in the car. So apparently any individual can avoid liability if they simply leave their drugs at home and then get in the car and drive away. Certainly, enforcement practicality is something the legislature was well attuned when they enacted this law, and they did not want to give a free pass to an individual who simply is wise enough from a prior arrest that as long as they keep the syringes out of the vehicle, they can get away with no liability. Public protection, which is the fifth Jadowski factor, plays right into enforcement practicality. Although there was a time where alcohol was essentially the only thing we noticed from impaired drivers, unfortunately the times have changed. It is now approximately 20% of vehicle crashes involve controlled substances, including THC and cocaine, and it is certainly reasonable for the legislature to want to address that problem. When we look to the final Jadowski factor, the punishment severity, a first offense is only a forfeiture. And repeat offenses can certainly lead to increased punishment, but it only does so after an individual has been through the court system in prior arrest. Ultimately, Mr. Lutke is the one who has the burden to overcome the presumption of constitutionality of the statute. Now, of course, he says, I'm not asking you to overturn it. I'm asking you to insert an element the legislature never put there. But that is one and the same goal. This court does not insert elements into statutes when they're constitutional. And so it is a clever way of trying to get around and do by indirect means what he cannot do by directly. And that is he cannot meet his burden of overcoming the presumption of constitutionality, and this court can't insert an element that doesn't exist. What is noteworthy from the Smet decision, which was a court of appeals decision looking into the constitutionality of this statute for not having an impairment requirement, they identified the proper level of scrutiny is one of simply a rational and reasonable basis. We're not in heightened scrutiny here. And it is noteworthy from the Stevenson decision that an individual challenging the constitution of a statute cannot use hypotheticals to other people. It is interesting and entertaining to understand the pot brownie, the gummy bear laced with cocaine, but that is all a clever ruse to avoid the facts of the cases. An individual who clearly falls within the statute cannot use hypotheticals to try to render it unconstitutional. We're not here to discuss something like this court confronted in DuBose, where it was looking at what the court deemed the single greatest cause of misidentification. We're not here to talk about a case where a person has incidentally ingested some substance. We're here to talk about two people, one who consumed marijuana at a sufficient level that they had high delta 9 levels, which is indicative of current use, and also one who had metabolite levels sufficient with chronic use. And we're here to talk about a person who had syringes, was hiding them in the sewer, had puncture marks in his arm, had to go through a drug recognition examination, which was indicative of impairment. Ultimately, the state's position is quite simple, that this court should respect the legislature's goals and language when it enacted the restricted controlled substance statute, and ultimately this court should honor the fidelity to precedent because there has not been the compelling reason presented to overrule it. Ultimately, the legislature intended to have safer highways, and that is what the state certainly believes this court should do in these decisions. Thank you.
But what precedent is there about Scienter here in this case?
Your Honor, the precedent would be at best the Smet decision, which looked at the impairment part. It does not look at the Scienter part. However, as a counsel for Lutke identified, these are completely independent issues, unrelated. And so the precedential prong is very relevant to the due process consideration. Here, though, on the second issue with Scienter, what this court has to do is look at burdens and presumptions. Statutes enjoy a presumption of constitutionality, and the burden, and it's not a light burden, it's a burden beyond a reasonable doubt that Lutke has to prove. And so that is the critical analysis this court undertakes on the Scienter question.
So do you say that we don't read in Scienter unless we find it unconstitutional without Scienter?
Correct. We have to get through the constitutionality prong. Otherwise, I see my time's expired. May I finish?
Yes.
It would undermine the entire presumption in favor of constitutionality if this court just jumped to Scienter. It would first have to deem a statute unconstitutional and then decide whether a narrowing or limiting construction could be inserted to uphold it.
If you were Attorney General, would you change anything on current procedure?
Your Honor, with respect to the current procedure, on the question of Scienter, I think it's best to have deference for the legislature, so there would be no value in changing that. On the issue of evidence retention and preservation, that is largely a legislative question in regards to resources and the time with which these various tests can be performed. Certainly everybody benefits from having evidence preserved, but preserving blood for the sake of preserving blood indefinitely, as the cases point out and as the unresolved facts in this court case, these cases point out, is that it's not likely to lead to any different result. Thank you.
Then why allow him to test at all?
What?
Then why allow the defendant to test at all?
That is the purpose of the second test in the field. The problem is as the sample gets degraded through time, you have two issues at play. First, that the result is unlikely to be different at all. And now you're dealing with a degraded sample. Cocaine is a very volatile substance that doesn't just sit in a stable act, and THC levels start to deteriorate through time. Now, it's perhaps more stable than cocaine. But that's why the legislature, in their wisdom, said the alternate test we're talking about here is the alternate test the night of. It's the a second draw, if that's what Lutke or Weitzinger want. It's a urine test. It's a breath test. That's a provision they're allowed. And frankly, the legislature's attuned to this. That's why they amended the statute to include great bodily harm, accidents, and death accidents. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Mr. Lang, I think you're next. You were to be reminded
of something.
Of something. Do you remember?
I'll try to briefly address the Scienter element, then move on to this discussion of destruction. I disagree with counsel wholeheartedly. I'm not attacking the constitutionality. This court's never had to find a statute unconstitutional before. It applied the general rule of construction, which is, in a criminal case, Scienter is the rule rather than the exception. There is nothing in the legislative history that suggests the legislature ever contemplated that people would be found guilty of this, even if they didn't even know they ingested the substance. While I offered some hypotheticals, Mr. Lutke isn't a hypothetical. He claims he didn't take any, didn't consume any. He is being held strictly liable nonetheless.
Could I ask, I believe I asked Mr. Boyle, how would the prosecution prove Scienter in his case?
Yeah, and I think he posed that question before, and I think counsel referred to it as impairment. Impairment, not disputing. If it's in your system, you're deemed impaired. But you got to at least know you ingested it. And so how would you show knowing ingestion? Multitude of factors can be employed. Circumstantially, like everything else, it's rarely direct evidence. But it could be. The defendant could admit he took it. Somebody could see him having taken it. He could have paraphernalia or other substance, you know, stuff on him. He could have cocaine in his pocket, in a packet. The substance level could be so high that there could be no other explanation but that he knowingly ingested it, because you just couldn't get to that without reaching that number in some unwitting way. And then it would become a question of fact for the jury whether they believed that or didn't believe that.
Was the bottle of white powder not cocaine?
There was no testing of any of those things. No evidence that any of them contained cocaine.
Okay, just so that never came into the trial of this at all.
With regard to this, I just feel compelled to respond. This 330 nanograms of the metabolite is extremely misleading, because my understanding from the Swedish study is the ratio, the average ratio from the amount consumed to the metabolite is like 14 to 1. So what we're talking about is 20-some nanograms. There's an indication on the website for the Department of Transportation about cocaine volumes. And the amount from a dose of cocaine usually is going to be many, 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 many times the nanogram amounts that we're talking about here. The nanogram's like a billionth of a gram, and we're talking milligrams in the dose that you would find.
But what's your point, that it's small?
It's very really, really small. So that a person could unwittingly ingest it, that the 330 nanograms of the metabolite aren't an indication of some gigantic consumption of cocaine. As to testing, the deterioration of a sample is really a hard claim to suggest or accept in my case, where the state itself waits 6 months to do the testing of the cocaine sample and then destroys it in February somehow. In that last few months, it somehow deteriorated to the point that it no longer has probative value. If it has probative value, that should be a jury question in the end. In terms of adhering to precedent, while there may be some precedent, it is really thin, and is it worthy of being followed? Why do we adhere to precedent when it basically tolerates unreliable outcomes? Because the best evidence that you could test and contest the state's evidence is unavailable because we just let it be destroyed. Norman Bay, in his article I referred to my brief, he said that the stare decisis value of young blood in itself is mighty thin, because DNA testing has shown it doesn't lead to reliable outcomes, but in fact permits innocent people to be found guilty. In terms of Wisconsin history, the Dish Ellen Walsted line of cases, they were decided really when there wasn't much federal precedent about the destruction of evidence at all. And when Trombetta was decided after these cases, Justice Marshall said, we're troubled here because we really don't have anything to hang our hats on in terms of precedent, and it's troubling to suggest that we should dismiss a case when we can only speculate what the other evidence might be. And so the Trombetta rule, followed by the Youngberg rule, basically demonstrates this reluctance to just have a dismissal. Greenwald assumed...
Isn't the Youngblood rule in effect here our precedent, because we generally, not always, but generally, court says they follow the federal rules to interpret the state constitution. So you got a federal rule that requires bad faith, right, which is the tough part here. So why isn't it right to say, I noticed that the state's brief uses Youngblood only at the very end and has all these other cases stacked up.
Yeah, Greenwald in the state cases assume that our due process clause was synonymous with the federal, and so we apply Youngblood. This court in DuBose indicates, well, no, it's not. It depends. If there was good reason not to follow the federal precedent, there's justification for doing it. And in this instance, consistency is bad practice. We shouldn't allow blood samples to be destroyed when, in fact, they could serve as valuable probative evidence. The state gains nothing from destroying this. It doesn't further the prosecution. In fact, it merely permits the conviction of innocent people. And obviously, it precludes Mr. Lutke from meeting the state's evidence with comparable testimony of an expert who's done testing. And I mentioned to remind me of remedy. Obviously, for the first issue, my request is for a jury or a new trial with a jury instruction on the scienter element. As to the second issue, Hoggett, who's a Youngblood case, struggled what the remedy should be for these destruction of evidence cases. And I think probably a wiser course is the one that most of the jurisdictions that have abandoned or at least rejected application of a strict Youngblood test is to require a jury instruction, not just that the evidence has been destroyed, but inviting jurors, permitting jurors to draw inference against the government when the government's destroyed the evidence. Being able to look back on 35 years, it always struck me that we got stuck with really bad identification law that tolerated unreliable practices because the remedy was always so onerous that you basically had to suppress the evidence and throw off the case, when perhaps a better course would have been to use jury instructions to advise jurors that the procedures used were suggestive, and you can use that in gauging whether or not the evidence is reliable or not. And in this instance, the all or nothing of the Youngblood test, either you dismiss the case or it goes to trial with no remedy, seems to be a bad all or nothing proposition. That consistent with the other jurisdictions that have rejected Youngblood, that we should have a new trial in this instance with a jury instruction telling jurors that the state has destroyed the evidence so the defense couldn't test it, and you can infer from that, though you're not required to do so, you can infer from that that the evidence would have been favorable to the defense. And that would be my request in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Boyle.
Very briefly. Counsel for the state indicated some things that I could have done or I might have done. He just misunderstands and forgets about the fact that it wouldn't have made any difference because the blood had been destroyed before she was charged. Justice Prosser brought up the question about jury trial just as an allusion. Judge Riley's dissent says cross-examination is something the defense lawyer has in this case, so saith the state, that gives us a some sort of an advantage in going to a jury and telling them about it. And then he kind of makes fun of that by saying the question was, are you really, 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 really sure that there was TAC in it? Well, he's right. That's how foolish it is. And having been doing this since 1962 or 65 as a prosecutor for a number of years and being deputy district attorney, I can absolutely assure you that when I walk away from a case, I say I had a fair trial. The judges don't agree with me most of the time or some of the time or a little of the time. It doesn't matter. I had a fair trial. But when I walk away from a case where the only evidence on the face of the earth for a conviction was destroyed for no reason whatsoever, and I'm told, well, you could have cross-examined the expert. I mean, that's just foolishness. Many a lawyer has made a horrible mistake in a trial before a judge and a jury and overdoing it with experts who kind of beat you up every time. I could not, under any circumstances, have won this case except for jury nullification. There's no other way it could have been won. And I think because of that, I said at the beginning about I know it when I see it. I know the lack of due process when I see it. And in my humble opinion, there is a lack of due process here. Thank you for the honor of having me appear here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Boyle. Thank you, Mr. Lang. And thank you, Mr. Collins, for your arguments today on a matter that we've had before and that the Court of Appeals has wrestled with in numerous cases. and this court will have to wrestle with, which ends our hearing in 2013 AP 1737 CR and 13 AP 218 CR, State versus Lukey and State versus Weisinger. And before we leave, I think we should all give a round of applause to Mr. Lang. We are in recess until tomorrow morning when we will have another three cases. It is 3 o'clock and the court will meet in closed session at 3:30.
3:30?
3:30.
Thank you.